Hoi, hoi.
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Oh, hi.
This is my very first time loading Zoom up on my new computer.
Oh, very
Ooh,
nice.
very exciting.
Does that have that new CPU pegging feel?
I mean, I'm not an expert on how pegging feels, but I'll say yes.
You can be a novice and still know your way around.
Right.
This is the first time that JJ and I have been hanging out waiting for you.
I
That is
know.
true.
How
How did that
exciting.
feel? Yeah,
That's good stuff. Yeah, it's Thursday normally when we do this. And I don't know about y'all, but this last week has felt like three. And I don't know why.
like three Thursdays or
Yeah, 3 weeks maybe.
three
I don't
weeks.
know.
Cool.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm down for whatever metric you're rolling with, man.
Yeah. Furlongs. I only use furlongs
Furlongs.
to
There you go.
determine time. Wait, Tisha, that doesn't make any sense. Exactly. That's the
So who hurt you this week? I mean,
point.
what's going on with you, JJ?
Well, okay, so there's a lot of stuff going around. Think is about to happen soon, and it's virtual again. So there's a lot of like hurry up and wait situations popping up, where the organizer, like every single conference is like this, right? Where they talk about it a month and a half earlier, and they're like, hey, can you get X, Y, and Z done? And you go off and you start working on it, but you never hear anything about like any due dates or anything like that. And then they come to you and be like, by the way, have you gotten that done yet? You're like, I'm no, like I didn't know you needed this for this time. And then they want to approve like slide decks and stuff to make everything look the same. And it's like other humans are running this and don't realize they have to work backwards. And it's always the last minute. And I feel like I've hit that wall again. Why can't we do better? Why can't we do better? Crickets.
Yeah, it's both relatable and outside of my expertise to see better. Yeah, I think I will stick to the thread that I want to pull on right now, which is it is baffling at just how many people it takes to just focus on keynotes for a conference
Yeah.
or like one slide deck. You're like, everyone's like, oh man, why does this suck, or what, why is this way? Why are these little events maybe not as good or not as great in whatever way? You're like, they're literally 80 people looking at a single slide deck and reviewing it with the speakers over and over again. Like if the talk you just saw at a conference wasn't as high a caliber, they don't have 80 fucking people to send after it. Like,
Exactly.
but also, like, does it really take 80 people? I have to question the sort of methodology of ownership when it comes to some of these messages. It's really the worst case scenario of corporate messaging ends up being the company-owned keynote.
Yeah, I feel like there is the corporate conference and then the community conference. And the community conference really embraces the ragged edges, whereas the corporate conference does not. And I think that's a very distinct difference. And that's why at your think At your VMworld, you're expected to have slides done like 3 months in advance so that they can put their slide people onto it to clean it up and make sure it's consistent. You have to, for VMworld, we were given instructions on like clothing choices.
What?
Yeah,
Really?
right. So,
Oh yeah,
I
that's super
mean,
normal.
of course, I
Yeah.
ignored them and just wore a random DevOps shirt, but that's. Like that's what the like that enterprise, come straight from the IBM Blue Blazer thing, right?
Yeah, I guess.
You gotta present yourselves a certain way. And that has over time sort of invaded every component of how a corporation does stuff, including events, and maybe even especially events, because they're such the, you know, the public face. Mm. You know, you're presenting to customers that you're asking for, you know, $100 million a year from. You'd better look good.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That stuff has a ripple effect of, like, if you look clumsy when you're presenting in front of people, that's going to affect their belief in your product as well. Mm-hmm. Like the basic psychology of the halo effect of that works positively and negatively around whatever given object they're looking at. We cast it in the same light as if they are one and the same. And it's whether it's valid or not, it's important. Yeah. It's makes a difference. And let's not forget that events only happen for lead gen, right? I'm saying this with ultimate sarcasm in my life. How do you all survive those conversations where they're like, well, this isn't this, when somebody like honestly says this event led to this many leads? I've gone back and forth on this a bunch, and I'd love to, you know,
just here's a great example. I won't name names, but I had to deal with a thing where at a previous job, a couple of jobs ago, we were like, I asked for money for sponsoring a DevOps conference. And they were like, well, we don't sponsor DevOps conferences because there's no ROI. When I dug into that, they means there's no badge scans or leads. And then fast forward a couple of months, they're asking how we can get more DevOps folks to our own events. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, that's your ROI from your community conferences, is getting in front of those people and getting enough trust from those people that they're willing to give you a day of their time or a couple of hours of their time. You know,
I kind of had that same conversation a while ago when we were allowed to obviously travel and do that stuff. Mm-hmm. But I quickly discovered it's not actually, at least for the metrics that my team was associated with, we had a budget for sponsorships. And we wanted what we called cloud activations. That was the term. It wasn't actually like lead gen of like email address, phone number or whatever. It was people actually using the IBM cloud or signing up for it. So what I learned to do was start running workshops at places and getting people to sign up for the IBM cloud there. So all the graphs you could see when I ran a workshop at random DevOps conference teaching the Kubernetes, right? All of a sudden they'd see this little graph of like very, very, very little, 45 people just signed up. What the hell? kind of thing. And they were like, whatever JJ is doing, this is working. We should get him on the road more. And it was because, you know, I would give a free workshop to a bunch of random DevOps people about how to do some random thing on the internet. And I'd give them a month free for a Kubernetes cluster that they could actually run a Bitcoin miner on at the time if they really wanted to.
But that's a great point, JJ. It's like, that's one of the rare cases where DevOps and DevRel and SaaS products like have this beautiful overlap where it's just like the aha moment of when you can actually activate new customers through your activities. Like that is the dream ROI graph, like you're showing where,
And I actually got some of those turned too to paid. That was the even crazier part.
Nice. I think that's also like calls back to the, what's the maxim? Like, tell me what you measure and I'll tell you how I'm going to behave.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
And be careful what you measure, because
exactly,
you might just get it.
Yeah.
It's, I think I just had a pretty hard knee jerk today when somebody was complaining about an event in relation to demand gen. And it's the ultimate lie that we tell ourselves as marketers. If you identify as that, I do at times, like I do now. And the funnel tells you that people are going through this linear process, and anything that happens up until the point where they sign a contract is like your direct influence on that sale. If But like, if you like do a causal map of who is showing up to your conference, well, you gave a bunch of free passes to people that were pretty far down your sales pipeline and are already going to spend millions, if not billions of dollars in the next few years. And all of a sudden your event had millions of dollars of ROI because people converted right after it. Like you've got the cause and effect incredibly reversed. And I think our wish to tell a linear story is getting in the way of the reality of the value that these activities provide.
Very much so. I mean,
I'll get off that anyway.
But by the way, is Jen with a G or a J for demand Jen? Demand Jen?
Yeah, there's just one lady named Jen who's Jen. In charge of all demand for all organizations. demand generation.
Yes.
So it's a it's a J like gif.
Gif. There you go.
It's a soft G.
Soft G. Oh, shit. Okay, well, that's a good enough rant for now. Glad we're DevOpsing and eventing. And Paul, you brought up a really good point, though. There's like this, I know, this one hop type idea of demand gen, of event connection that I think people miss, like the influential pattern of being in places that people notice so they will come to your thing.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's got that gets lost in translation sometimes. So.
There's a lot of intangible like networking effects that I don't even know if you can measure, but are I think pretty important. And well,
you
so
can't
I think
stop
it's,
me from trying.
Yeah, I can't stop you from trying. And you know, ultimately, you need to measure something so that you know if you should like fire me or keep me employed. But I think there's also something to be said for like not getting too wound up around that measurement and being like, you know, just do it. And as long as your overall cost is within a certain budget and that certain budget is supported by the amount of new business you're getting or whatever you're measuring, you know, revenue wise, then maybe that's okay. And certainly you couldn't run an entire marketing org that way, but there's no reason to not have some little maverick portions of your marketing org that can run that way. Because that in a way gives you the ability and the permission to like be a bit experimental and do some other things. Like JJ can spend 24 months like just gorilla building out a streaming like practice without having to worry about the fact that he's measuring like increased eyeballs month over month. And instead it's just like, it's within our experimentation budget or our 20% time budget or whatever, maybe engineering kind of concept you could put against it to make it seem like something that is real. You know, maybe there's something there.
I like that. Yeah, it's the acknowledgement that to try to measure all the quantification will cost more time than it would take to do the right work and leave right. some slack space. I'm definitely not going to remember this correctly, but it has to do with like bookkeeping too. Like the amount of money there's something I'm thinking of those looking at corporations that made expense reports like have to be reconciled down to the penny and versus ones that had like a $50 wiggle room for people.
Right.
And the ones that had wiggle room, even though there is some money lost in each individual thing, it added up to a huge cost savings when it came to just the scrutiny, the cost of scrutiny at that level is significant and it's underestimated in measurement probably. I mean, I'm going to say across the board. I'm curious about measuring everything, but I've got to remember like sometimes just do the work instead of worrying about measuring it. but right. like do it within a logical framework where you're like, exactly. I know what our goals are and I know what winning, what success looks like. I know what the boundaries are to mm-hmm. some degree. Just get shit done. Like give it a go.
I'm really worried about that.
Close from reinventing extreme programming though.
Exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead, JJ.
I was going to say there's that thing, the pesky SEC that wants that stuff for public companies reconciled from what I understand though. And of course, as I say now, it's not funny and it's not the right timing because my jokes are horrible.
That was a joke.
I tried, like it was going to be a timed joke because I hear timing is important. Like I'm working on my jokes here.
It doesn't show.
It really, like I'm, you know, just going to keep working on it. We're going to workshop it back and forth and eventually I'll get the right timing. By the way, no, I messed that one too.
You'll get there. Statistically, you'll hit one eventually.
Eventually.
At what cost?
I don't know anymore.
It's free. It's free to him. We're the ones paying the cost.
pay it backwards.
Pay it backwards. Oh, JJ. Yeah. That was a good way to clear the conversation. What's up next?
I hear something about a wok and seasoning a wok recently. What's going on there?
So I had a wok that looked a little too.
Did you stand up? Did you stand up and walk a little bit? No,
it's an upright wok. Exactly.
Yeah.
God damn it. Yeah. So if you're a frequent listener, you've probably heard that I've been wok hunting for a while. I finally found one that was met all the specifications of size and flat bottom and right handle type and thickness, which was the hardest thing to find. Because most of them are they're usually around 1.5 millimeters from what I'm finding.
Freedom units.
Millimeters. It's fine.
Freedom units. I need freedom units.
It's like 16. It's gauge 16 is usually the other way it's put. It's too damn thin. It basically, you can't hold enough heat in it to brown meat. So like it you'll absorb all the energy out of it by the time the Maillard reaction starts to happen, because science, and read good books about it. But with 2 millimeters or gauge 14 ish, you can get to this. Yeah, this better balance of heat and weight and all that stuff, because it's pretty freaking heavy. But all that aside, I've got the right wok, and Paul thankfully basically watched the paint dry of me trying to season that thing, because I screwed up at least twice. If you want to take it over from there, Paul.
I mean, I don't want to like do a play-by-play replay of how badly you screwed up, but I gotta say, you did pretty well, right? You know, if you were doing that without someone who's done it before helping you, it would have gone pretty horribly. You would have tried cooking on it a few times. You would have realized that it had gone horribly. You would have done your best to get all the seasoning off it and then redone it. And that would have happened 2 or 3 times until you sort of figured it out and got it right. And so I was just there to try and get you to that third attempt without having to go through the first couple of failed attempts. So for those who don't know what we're talking about exactly, let's take a step back. And so we're talking about carbon steel woks and carbon steel pans, whether they're woks or whether they're not, require seasoning in the same way that a cast iron pan does. So basically what you're doing is you are applying a very thin layer of oil and then you are heating it to the point that it polymerizes and forms a very thin layer on top of the metal, which is effectively a hardened plastic. And so to do that right, you need pretty high heat and time, and you also need it to be a very thin layer of oil. Otherwise it gets splotchy and sticky and gross because it can't polymerize at that thickness. So you basically clean it really well, which was kind of where you went wrong to start with. You didn't have a good scrubbing device to give it a good clean.
Yeah, I thought I just had to, like, you know, run over it with something that feels kind of brush like. But I ended up scraping the shit out of it after.
The best way I've found, are those the sponges that are like a sponge on one side and then like a scratchy sponge on the other side. And so you give it a really you give it a really high heat. Basically you add hot water and some soap and you scrub the shit out of it when it's come from the store, because it's going to have weird crap on it, right? And then you give it really high heat until the steel basically turns like a bluish purple color, and you want to get that sort of consistent across the wok. And then you add water to it, add a bit of soap to it, and you scrub it again. And that should get rid of any of the machine oils, any of the weird things. And then you're in a spot where you have to act pretty quick, because now there's no like factory seal covering on it. It'll like rust real quick. And so you have to pretty much get the water off it right away. And you do that by giving it a towel off and then heating it. And then once you've got it hot, you can then, not like blisteringly hot, but like getting warm. You then add some oil, like just a tablespoon or so of like really high heat resistant, high smoke point oil. You rub that on, and then you basically heat it until it polymerizes. Because it's a wok, you kind of need to move it around a bit, make sure it's heated across. And then you do that oil process two or three times. And that generally gives you a good enough coating that you can then start like frying and deep frying, shallow frying, and then eventually stir frying on it, right? And so the more coating you have on it, the better non-stick it'll have, and the more things you can cook in it with less oil without them sticking. And then, of course, every time you cook on it, you want to still use oil, and you do what is called, I'm going to butcher the Chinese pronunciation, but long yao, which is basically you, in a restaurant situation, you just pour a bunch of oil in it and then pour it back out. In a home situation, you get it pretty hot, like not to its maximum heat, but pretty hot. You turn the heat off, you put maybe a couple of tablespoons of oil in it, and then you swirl that around to make sure that every part of the pan that you'll be cooking on has had like some oil on it, and that'll make it non-stick enough to like even like fry an egg in.
Hell yeah, I'm into it.
Yeah, so that's kind of what we did. And you know, you had a couple of, because you didn't quite have the right scrubbing brush, and there was at one point you let it, the oils stay a bit thick, so it created like a sticky patch. So we had to basically use a steel wool to scrub that back and then reapply seasoning where you'd scraped it off. But all in all, I think you did pretty well. Now, have you actually cooked on it yet?
I'm not. I'm planning to tonight.
All right.
I'm going to prep I've got some skin on, bone in chicken thighs that I'm going to trim up, take the bone out and flatten, and then turn into like some fried chicken with some panko and flour.
Perfect.
Is what I hope to mess around with. And then, yeah, if all looks well, I have a bunch of Chinese broccoli I was going to stir fry in there after, if it's not too soon, Paul. I need permission.
You're probably fine. I don't want to, we probably won't go into too much detail, but when you're cooking in a wok, things like, you said Chinese broccoli?
Yeah.
Or cauliflower?
Broccoli.
Broccoli. Okay. So what I usually do is, so there's a technique in Chinese cooking that's basically called passing through oil. And basically you give it a really quick deep fry and then you stir fry it. And that helps things like broccoli like hold its color, but it also helps speed up the cooking process, right? Because the deep fry is at a very high temperature, but also like covering the whole thing, whereas the stir fry, you're sort of cooking like one side at a time,
right?
So what you can do to emulate that, because you probably don't want to be going through gallons of oil to do that, is you can actually like give it a quick boil or steam, or I'll actually sometimes just throw it in the microwave for a couple of minutes.
Yeah,
just do. To do like an initial par cook and then finish it off in the wok. And I find that can help.
Nice.
Same with doing meats, although I won't microwave meats for it, but I will like doing like beef, for maybe like beef and broccoli. I might still have it coated in like the cornstarch or whatever, but give it a really quick boil, like 30 seconds, a minute tops, and then stir fry it. And that helps set the, it helps gel the cornstarch or potato starch or whatever you're doing with it, and then also helps it sort of start the cooking process. And that will also help with non-stickiness.
Did I hear you correctly? You put your meat in the microwave and A1 sauce on top of it?
Yeah, that's exactly what I said, JJ. I'm glad that's the takeaway you just told me.
He really likes the uneven cooking of a nice piece of steak. Exactly. He wants to see the microwave line through it.
That's what the red line's for, right? Isn't that right? No?
Exactly. Yep. He calls that tiger striping. Okay.
Nice. That's good. That's good. That's good.
It's fancy because it's got a name. Speaking of fancy ways to do dumb things, JJ, you brought up a good way to catch some anti-phishing bullshit from IT.
Yes. So I don't know if he actually listens or not, but I want to shout it out to Joshua Timberman. I was in a Slack that he was talking in, and he shared out this gist that I'll put into the show notes, where if you use Gmail or Gmail as your email system. So if you have like your corporate email on Gmail or whatever, you know what I mean? And you can run scripts on there. There's a company called Before You Know, or Know Before or something to that effect. Yeah, no, KNOWBE4. Is a phishing company that companies can like send phishing emails out to their employees and all. And it turns out we figured out that they put a header in their emails to get it past all the spam filters, right? So obviously, as soon as people figure this out, it's been riddled with abuse already. And this is all within like the last 12 hours of people figuring this out. But people have also written a very simple script on Google Scripts or whatever that can run every minute or so that will find that header also and just immediately send it to DevNull. So you don't get hit with the phishing emails. You don't get hit with any spam emails that your IT company is spending, or IT org is probably spending way too much money on to build directly to DevNull, that you don't have to worry about it. I thought that was pretty neat.
Nice.
That is handy. A good way if you are, I mean, I appreciate that IT has to kind of keep things realistic so that people can see what the risk profile looks like, but also makes you feel like you can't trust your own team when you are getting random emails that are trying to get you to screw up. So
I'll put another link to a tweet from someone who did this, whose company did this exact same thing right as the pandemic was starting, and actually put in like $1,000 bonus or something like that, but you have to log in.
Oh, basically, yeah.
And like it's riddled throughout our industry too. And I understand that they want to test the system, and they want to make sure their employees are vigilant, but you don't have to be an asshole about it, right? And that's just what these companies are starting to do. So what do? We use our technology to basically say, you just spent $10,000 to run this phishing expedition. We just shit that to DevNull now, and now we've just wasted money across the board. We can be assholes too, IT, right?
Yeah. I feel like there was a... I think GoDaddy did something similar a few years back.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that one too. Yeah. Oh, God. Idiots.
Yeah. Not cool.
Idiots.
Not cool. You know, yeah, try and find a way to do the things you need to do with some empathy for the people you're doing it to.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I don't know why it's so hard for that concept to get through to people.
And is it
hard?
Is it fishing with an F or a PH?
If you live in Pflugerville, it's with a PF.
Ah, there you go. Good call. Good call.
That's a very Austin-specific joke. Sorry, Matt.
I was like, I'm clearly out of this circle. I don't know what a Pflugerville is. But whatever. No, I'm not going down there. Anyway, speaking of things that also don't make sense to JJ, or, yeah, I feel like that's just a general theme of one of our segments. But JJ,
I feel like it's a general theme of our entire show.
Well, it's you teaching me food, JJ possibly chewing on bread while saying I don't get it, which is very enjoyable. But JJ, there's something with serverless that you ran into. I want to hear all about it.
Yeah. So I've been going on some quests to try to understand serverless, because there's some major pushes, especially internally at IBM, because we've invested a lot of time in Knative and things like that, to really understand it. And I've heard conversations, and I think I finally got my head wrapped around it. I want to tip my hat to Alex Ellis from the OpenFAS project, because he wrote a book that finally taught me enough about what serverless is and the reason why you should even care about it, in a very engineering practical way, to be able to see that there is actual value props for it.
Can I give you a hot take? And then you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, and then tell me what it really is.
Sure.
All right. So to me, serverless is cron in the cloud, but can be triggered by things that aren't just time.
Okay. That's not too far off. That's not too far off. I'll give you points for that. What about you, Broberg? How do you see serverless?
I think of it first as a great way to start a fight. second as a lazier way to think through things functionally. And then third as like what I really like when we stop using serverless and we talk about functions as a service, mm-hmm. I think about infrastructure you're providing me to deploy, test, and trigger like discrete functions that are interconnected to provide some sort of, you know, outcome. So it's lighter weight than containers, more functional programming, regardless of whether the language itself is object oriented or functional. Mm-hmm. I just want to think in these like functional steps of passing information from one point to the next. But I haven't messed around with, I played around with OpenFAS a bit, and then I don't really use much of the large cloud providers. So I kind of backed out and just went back to what I do, which is dick around with Zapier. So I guess I'll go full circle and say, like, isn't it just Zapier, but for corporations?
Okay.
So one thing that jumps out at me, since you got to give several points, is anytime I think serverless, I immediately think of Simon Wardley having long conversations with himself on Twitter threads,
which make me very happy. I think those are so fun, but I don't know if you're saying that in a fun way or God damn it, why do people do that way?
Yeah. Go with whichever makes you feel good.
Cool. All right, JJ, tag in.
Okay. So first of all, your interpretations, or at least from what I've seen, my inner understanding of it is a Venn diagram that hits both of y'all's stories, right? Where the intersection of what you said and how I see it is very accurate. Now, at this exact moment in time, serverless has slowly but surely turned into another way to run containers. That's what it has. Not we're talking about fast or sorry, functions as a service. But we're just talking serverless in quotes, right? Where you just want a way to scale down to zero some little container that can spin up to as big as it needs to be, as many parallel jobs as possible on an infrastructure, and then scale down to zero when you're not using it. Now, there are ways you can wrap those functions up as not containers, right? But with Lambda supporting containers now too, and the Knative ecosystem using containers, and now the Code Engine, which is a new version at IBM, they focus really solely on containers because, to Broberg's point, it's a functional narrative to help get microservices out the door without needing the infrastructure underneath it.
Well, hang on. So I'm not sure, aren't microservices really bigger than what FAS or serverless is built for?
So there's a little bit of a line between FAS and serverless, even though FAS to me is inside the Venn diagram of serverless, okay. Right? So one of the ways that I got my head wrapped around it is that I basically got that famous Hugo blog we all use and love to build to kind of show how to build a container and do something. I got it working on Code Engine, right? I built the Hugo
No one knows what Code Engine is.
It's the serverless platform that IBM's coming out with, which is a direct competitor to Lambda, right? And it was just kind of like you know how you do your Hugo blog on Kubernetes when you're first learning how to build a deployment, and you first learn how to build an ingress and all that jazz. You put that up there, and now you have this massive Kubernetes cluster that costs you $6,000 a month that runs literally one container. That's your Hugo blog. That joke, right? Well, the interesting thing is that same joke naturally works really well inside of the serverless architecture that can run containers, which I forget the one from Google also, but there's one over on Google's side too. I don't know about Azure though.
They all have one.
Yeah. And so, but then instead of you spending $6,000 and having to be a Kubernetes expert, now you can just literally do it with a handful of commands and push it right up into the serverless platform, and it costs you not even pennies a month to run that blog. So all of a sudden you've abstracted away the need and the understanding of the infrastructure again, and we're going back to developers have to just focus on getting their code built to be put into the Heroku-like application or world that runs your thing down to zero and is supposed to run to zero. Does that make sense?
Sure. I mean, I get what you're saying. I just feel like I don't feel like that's really serverless or FAS. I feel like that is auto scale groups that scale to zero and know when to scale back up to one or more. Right. And I feel like that's kind of somewhat hijacked the serverless story. And I think that's a shame, because then it becomes what people want to talk about is scale to zero applications and not the discrete functions that you tie together to create a something that takes one thing, transforms it, and outputs something else. And so I think that's where Matt was talking about with the, when he was saying what he sees it as. I think that really hits what I think its more original intention is. And I get that, no plan survives contact with the enemy or whatever metaphor you want to use. But I do feel it is in a lot of ways a shame that we've kind of almost dumbed it down to mean something that we were already almost doing. versus... That's a
great way to... I mean, don't you remember Cloud?
This is an iterative process, right? Like, we had to... Like, there's still people out there who are running massive WAR files as their deployment for their business logic, right? And they're just understanding how to break things into microservices. The jump from what Broberg was saying about functions as a service is too large of a leap for you to get to that point. So this is a intermediate step of understanding how you can run microservices in a way that you can utilize costs in a better way. It all boils down to money, right?
Sure. Like, but it also comes down to, like, are people getting to the promised land? And if they're not, they'll just change the destination.
Right.
Like, I meant that with sarcasm and accuracy here. I think to say what serverless is today is to really change what I understood it to be just a couple years ago and a couple years before that, where it really was a future where we're going to decompose monoliths and microservices alike into just a collection of composable functions. And there will be some sort of configuration file that interacts across those composable functions. And we're just going to be kind of like being a developer, or I maybe an operator. I don't really know where we were supposed to go. Like, it's just managing the event source, like catalog of like where things are coming from and triggering. But like, it was really hard. It's hard to think that way. That's why functional programming is not as popular as object oriented in many ways. And it's hard to do that at scale because it gets really freaking messy. Like, I remember seeing a presentation of somebody remaking like a Postgres query in functions in Lambda. And it was like 8,000 functions to make it as resilient as a Postgres query. Like, maybe the whole world isn't one size fits all is like my biggest takeaway from this categorization. It's still worth discussing and defining accurately, but like, I guess I'm with Paul that's saying like, it's been such a moving target. It's tough to put your finger on.
Yeah. And I feel like one thing, JJ, what you said is like, JJ, you said it's a big step to go from one to the other. I guess what I'm saying, and I think what Matt is saying, is it doesn't have to be you go from one to the other, because you're using the right thing for the right job, right? You have an API server that's built in, I don't know, Java or whatever. There's zero reason to ever run that API server in finger quote serverless, except for the fact you want scale to zero. So let's solve scale to zero on our existing methods of doing auto scaling, right? And let's not muddy the serverless conversation and the FAS conversation with that. And let's focus the FAS serverless conversation at the, like, the data transformation type stuff it's really good at. So, like, I feel like it's really interesting and useful in the business to business type applications, right? You have an insurance company that needs to talk to a what do you call them? The places that fix
panel shop. Mechanic?
Like, right? A panel shop, like a large corporation, like panel shop and an insurance, right? They probably have some interface that talk to each other, and it's probably through FTPing or maybe SFTPing some files, right?
It's true.
And then running a bunch of things every second night to turn them into something that can be injected into a database. So a good example I saw, this was a couple of years ago, was actually around that, where they were using the Amazon stuff, and basically they uploaded the stuff via SFTP, but that was actually just going to S3, and that kicked off a function that would take that and turn it into a CSV, because it wasn't quite a CSV. And that would then, the output of that would be something in S3, and that would kick off a job that would then inject it into the data platform it needed to go into. So it was like three, I think there was actually a few more steps, but there's three or four like transformation steps. And then they all got lined up using, there's some like pipelining tool in Amazon to like tell it like to how to step through different transactions. And so then you had this way to take the data from another company, transform it into something that you can use without needing to write a big old Java app that's sitting there running, waiting for something to happen, or running once every couple of days when there's enough to be worth, you know, running it on. Either way, the server it's running on probably sitting there idle in between.
Yeah.
That to me is the promised land of serverless or FaaS. And I feel like we've kind of forgotten that in the rush to the scale to zero application. And I blame Kubernetes.
I do too.
Who doesn't? But all I can think of is I'm sad for all of us for the loss of said awk and grep skills that we will lose as we actually use like serverless functions in place of that. Because everything you just said, I was thinking through like how I've parsed out like, you know, commands that are unstructured data and like attempted to find structure in them using GNU Linux utilities.
Well, I feel like that was kind of one of the really sweet spots that Perl sat at. It was really good at doing that kind of thing. And so
exactly
10 years ago, we all had a massive catalog of Perl scripts to do like data transformation for things. And then they would be in cron or whatever to do it, you know, in batches at appropriate times.
I still have my Nagios box. Of course, I have a bunch of Perl scripts to do my work for me.
Right.
Good for you. Yeah, I know your
kids. To those of you who don't know, Nagios is what your grandparents use to monitor their server infrastructure.
It's true.
Little known fact, their headquarters for the company behind Nagios is in the Twin Cities of Minnesota. Oh. Yeah, when I looked up Nagios and I saw it was on the map like 10 minutes from my house, I definitely thought about moving. But it was strange.
You should go out where the sign is and just like point to it. And I'll make it one of our pictures for one of our episodes.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
Sounds like too much effort. And it's probably not called Nagios, right? It's some holding company, so it wouldn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I like it. I still like it. Well, heck, what else is going on?
Broberg just gets like a random like Home Depot or something, takes a picture of it, and like, here you go, JJ. I'm like, God damn it, Broberg.
Just like Photoshop Nagios across the Home Depot sign. Go to Target headquarters, send you Nagios picture.
Oh, God.
This has gotten dumb. All right, we're getting towards the top of the hour. What are people cooking soon? I already told you I'm going to try to make some fried chicken in that freshly minted wok. How about you all?
Well, I can talk about what I just cooked last night because it was an interesting experiment. I made dashi in a coffee pot.
What?
So dashi is a Japanese broth that is made from kombu, which is seaweed. And then it usually has some other things like bonito flakes and sometimes like some other dried fishy things, sometimes some like shiitake mushrooms. And it's kind of like it's a soup or stock base, but it's almost brewed like a tea. And in fact, you can get like instant dashi tea bags, which are actually really good. And so I'd been flopping this idea around in my head for quite a while that why can't I just stick all this stuff into a coffee pot filter and turn the coffee pot on. And so I actually did it last night and it worked. And like, I didn't really pay attention to recipes or anything. And so it wasn't the best dashi I've ever had, but it was totally serviceable into turning into a pretty delicious ramen.
And so, question for you, first off, very cool. Secondly, what do you think the temperature gets to in that coffee maker? I was so interested in that.
Usually, the water has to boil, right? But by the time it gets up through the siphon and down again, it's probably a little bit under boiling. So I would say it's probably around like the 190 to 200 degrees, which is about what you want to be making, like brewing tea or coffee at anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and same for like the dashis I've made when I was trying to make some shoyu, right. Like the nice crisp, clear, clean mm-hmm. broths. Like you wanted to get to sub boiling, but as right. close as you can to get there without boiling.
Exactly.
So that's pretty cool. But you said it didn't like knock your socks off. What was missing from it?
Well, I mean, I think just actually having a real recipe and like following it and making sure that I have the right amounts of the right ingredients and the right amount of salt, all that sort of stuff. I kind of just did it as a last minute, as an experiment. And I kind of knew that roughly 10 grams each of those things and 4 cups of water would give me a rough
got you.
Version of one. So I kind of just did that. I didn't, if I looked up some recipes and put more attention into it, and also I need to figure out like if I need to grind it or if I should leave it whole. There's a bunch of stuff I need to figure out, because if I grind it, there's going to be more surface area, so it should extract quicker.
But I think that adds like a bittering agent, or like I know there's something about kombu where it can get quite bitter depending mm-hmm. on how long and how hot and how much surface you're covering.
Right.
I don't know it well enough to advise, but I just know I stick to the recipe pretty closely and I still screw it up right now.
Yeah.
But super cool idea, Paul. It feels very, like Japanese YouTube-y.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually pinged a few like ramen people and said, is this a thing? Like, I feel like I can't be the first person to think of doing that. And the replies were, some people have done similar things with like siphon coffee machines, but they don't know of anyone that's done it with like just a regular old drip coffee pot.
Yeah, very cool. JJ, any food stuffs you've been up to?
Yes, actually. And I think I didn't report back. I believe last week I was going to report back on the cakes that I was going to be making.
Oh, yeah. You strawberry cake.
Yeah. So
you were gonna drop some off for me and you didn't.
Well, let me finish my narrative. Thank you very much. So it's very well known. I'm a type 1 diabetic. And I don't get to have a lot of sweets in general, just because I want to live. And so last week my little brother gave me his cake recipe. And they were having a little bit of a family get together. And so I made 6 cakes over 4 days.
That's a lot of cakes.
Yes.
Yeah. How's your body, buddy?
I only ate maybe 1 or 2 portions of one of the cakes, but roughly.
I ate 1 or 2 cakes.
There is a subtle pause there that was concerning.
But the funny part was, luckily one of the times I was crashing in the middle of the night. So I just basically went, whoa. On the cake, which is good, brought my blood sugar right back up. But I have now iterated multiple base things with this cake recipe. So I can now control the fluffiness that I want, the color that I want, the sweetness compared to the non-sweetness to it. Like I've figured out all the knobs and dials with this recipe to be able to actually come out with the style of cake that I want at the end, to be able to actually like make it look pretty and everything. It did take a few iterations. 6 cakes is quite a few in 4 days. But by the time we had that meal with my larger part of my family, they were like, JJ, you did this over like 4 days of learning. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of just did it. And they're like, this is really good. So I even got my nice. Mom and my dad's like nod of approval from it, which doesn't happen very often.
Oh, wow.
Now, is this a recipe story that you might be able to share at some point?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So
is
I can
like
easily
the 6 egg cake?
Yes, it's that 6 egg cake one. Yeah. It turns out I have the notes on how to do different things. Turns out those 6 eggs. Like I used a sliding scale to try to figure out what worked with it, but it turns out that 6 eggs is actually really important. It worked. The amount of fat that it brought into it to do what it needs to get done. We tried to cut it down to three. We did four and we did six. And we ended up finding out that six with the correct amount of injection of air into the batter for the time that when you're doing the 10 or 15 or 8 to 10 minute initial spin of to get the aerated all actually made a huge difference for all the different iterations we tried. So I engineered the fuck out of it.
Now, do you separate the eggs or do you use the eggs whole?
I use the eggs whole. So the first minute of it is just to break up the yolks to make sure there's no clumps. And then you start putting in the cup of sugar in there down the side. And then you turn on your stand mixer on high and basically let it sit and run for 8 to 10 minutes, closer to 10 minutes than not for at least some of the ones I was doing. And it did exactly what I was hoping to do.
Nice.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Well, I look forward to getting the recipe so I can try this myself.
Will do, sir. And I know you'll just make it better and then all of a sudden I'll lose my ability to say I did well.
I won't do that.
No, but he's going to put like chili crisp on it. So it's going to get weird.
It's going to get weird.
I enjoy the old chili crisp, but I'm not that particular kind of chili crisp asshole.
Well, I'll even play along. I'd love to learn to bake a little. So good info for next episode. Thank you all for listening. Have a great weekend and take care of yourselves.
Bye.
And go get vaccinated, motherfucker.
I lost the stop button.